Welcome to Talking Beats with Daniel Lalchuk. That's me, and I'm so glad you're here. If you like what we do, I'd love it if you gave us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And if you're so compelled, write a review. That really helps, and maybe tell a friend or family member. They might like the show as much as you do. If you want to get involved in the program, visit our website, talkingbeats.com, and click Support the Show, where you can make either a one-time or a recurring donation. As we look to continue having cliche-free conversations of real substance with a diverse range of the world's most compelling people, your support is so appreciated, especially as we look to expand and increase our offerings. If you have a question, comment, or thought, find us on social media, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, or if you wish to reach out directly, email me at daniel@talkingbeats.com. I'm so glad you're here. Let's get on with today's conversation. On today's program, a deep dive into the volatile, chaotic, violent, and difficult to decipher situation in Afghanistan. We're joined by two great experts on Afghanistan and on counterterrorism worldwide. The first, no stranger to this program, Bruce Hoffman. He's been studying terrorism and insurgency for 4 decades. He's a tenured professor at Georgetown in the School of Foreign Service. He was appointed by the U.S. Congress to serve as commissioner on the Independent Commission on 9/11 and was a lead author on the commission's final report. He was scholar in residence for counterterrorism at the Central Intelligence Agency between 2004 and 2006 and is a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Professor Hoffman, Bruce Hoffman, is here with his research associate, Jacob Ware, who studies counterterrorism at the Council on Foreign Relations. He writes articles with Bruce Hoffman that are widely read, widely respected. Most recently, the two of them chillingly penned an article titled "The Afghanistan Withdrawal and Taliban Takeover Mean the Terror Threat is Back." It's a rapidly evolving situation, and I hope the two of them can help us make some sense of it all. Bruce Hoffman, welcome back to this podcast. I'm thrilled to have you, sir.
Thank you for having me back again.
And Jacob Ware, your first time. Welcome to you, sir. When I wrote you to come on here and talk, there had been no big attack at the airport in Kabul. There was still plenty to talk about. In fact, this situation in Afghanistan, the U.S. withdrawal was the thing to talk about. Now we have had this huge attack. Hundreds of Afghani killed, 13 U.S. military killed. In terms of change, Bruce Hoffman, what does this change, if anything?
It certainly puts more pressure on the Biden administration to wrap up the evacuation, certainly by the due date, especially because we're dependent on the Taliban for security, and we can see that that dependency is not terribly encouraging. So alienating the Taliban and having the potential, as they have warned of attacks both from the Taliban as well as from ISIS-K, as well as from the Taliban's allies and Al-Qaeda and the Haqqani network, I think is something, given yesterday's tragic events, that we certainly don't want to contemplate.
What do you think is the worst that could happen? Everybody keeps saying this is the worst case scenario, but we could wake up tomorrow, or you could get a text on your phone in the middle of the night tonight saying there was another one of these. All it takes is 1 second for another bomb to be set off, for another suicide bomber to go in. I mean, it could get worse, right?
Yes. This is the paradox about counterterrorism, is that terrorists, you know, can attack virtually any target they wish at the time of their choosing, whereas it's enormously difficult for us to defend every conceivable target against every possible attack. That said, terrorists are also fundamentally opportunists. They seek to elbow themselves into the limelight, to steal some of the thunder for themselves, to take advantage of chaos and instability, and also to prey upon our distraction or preoccupation with something else. So in other words, nowadays, we're laser focused on the evacuation from Afghanistan, on top of a spiraling COVID pandemic fueled by the Delta variant, not just in the United States, but in around the world, by the phenomena of great power competition with China and Russia, with attempting to forge some new nuclear agreement with Iran, the daily omnipresence of cyber attacks, for example. I mean, we've got enough on our plate. And of course, that's exactly when terrorists are the most dangerous, because they seek to take advantage of any distraction, any complacency, any lowering of our guard to strike. So we have to be, I think, enormously vigilant, the more so now, and especially given the terrible events of that we saw at the Kabul airport.
Jacob, where you look at terrorism, counterterrorism, insurgencies all around the world, you've been doing that for a long time. Here we are in summer, coming into fall of 2021, 20 years after we went into Afghanistan. Obviously, Afghanistan hasn't been in the news constantly for the past 20 years. It's been forgotten by many people in the media, many people in the American public. Had you been zoomed in on the situation in Afghanistan long before we were, we as in the general public who care but might not be researching it, when did you zoom in there?
Well, I think Afghanistan has been an issue, you know, for the past 20 years, an ever-present issue for scholars of counterterrorism. It's not something that's ever gone away. You know, I will say that, contrary to public belief, the counterterrorism mission in Afghanistan has been pretty successful if you define it narrowly. We've had, between 9/11 and I think 2019, we actually had no terrorist attacks on US soil coordinated by a foreign terrorist organization. The first one since was an attack on a naval base in Pensacola, Florida, coordinated by Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. So this has been something that, of course, always pops across the radar of those of us who work in counterterrorism. You know, I think until the past couple of weeks, it certainly had been an issue that was in the back seat compared to certain other terrorism problems, extremism problems that had emerged over the past several years. Clearly, that's not true anymore. Clearly, now Afghanistan has, and the groups that are present there have risen straight to the very top of our priority list.
When Bruce Hoffman was on with me last time, it was pre-election 2020. He was predicting violence in the United States at the hands of what he called terroristic threats in the United States. And in fact, until recently, when I was thinking about talking to him again, I thought we would sort of talk about the dangerous situation in the United States and also with various terrorist cells in Europe and Germany and other countries. But here we are, the old story again, right? Is it a vacuum that's being left that could devolve into absolute hell more than it is now?
Well, clearly, this is an additional problem that feels self-inflicted and that we didn't need. You know, I'll just point out that I think counterterrorism right now is dealing with two crises. The first being that we're dealing with multiple threats that are multiplying. So I believe last time, you know, Bruce was on your show, he was talking about far-right extremism, and we saw, you know, in the interim period how dangerous that can be at the US Capitol. We're also dealing with QAnon and an extremism threat there. We deal with incels and that extremism threat. Of course, Syria and Iraq are still issues. Yemen, still an issue. There's growing concern over the Sahel and sub-Saharan Africa and some of the groups that are active there, including the Islamic State. And now we have Afghanistan. So you're adding problems onto the plate. The other crisis that's kind of running adjacent to that is the fact that basically counterterrorism as a field and as a national security priority is kind of bleeding resources. You know, Bruce and I are counterterrorism scholars, so I don't think there's much debate among the two of us, you know, whether this makes the US less safe. It certainly does. But I think the question here is actually bigger. The question is less, does this make the terrorism threat worse? And I think the question is more, how much are we actually prioritizing counterterrorism? On 9/11, of course, terrorism quickly became our number one national security priority. And we've had the luxury over the past 20 years that it pretty much has been number one the whole time. But I'd say over the last 5 years or so, it's been joined by a number of other very, very pressing national security concerns. Chief among them is obviously the China issue. You've also got the Russia issue. You've got North Korea and Iran and the nuclear question, cyber threats, pandemics are going to be a big thing going forward. And then the number one existential threat of them all, in my opinion, climate change. So even if you do, you know, believe that counterterrorism is the number one concern, we have multiple threats. And the reality is most people don't believe counterterrorism is the number one concern, and we're losing resources as the threat is multiplying and becoming much more diverse. So we really are heading into quite possibly a dark period for counterterrorism, where our law enforcement, intelligence, just simply are not going to be able to cover every base.
Yeah, and if I could jump in and add something. 20 years ago, not only did we have a focus on counterterrorism and these other problems really weren't front and center, but we had an enormous bipartisan consensus that this was the main problem, much as during the Cold War. We had an enormous consistent bipartisan consensus that the Soviet Union was a threat. The problem today, in addition to everything that Jacob has described, is that not only is there profound divisiveness and polarization between the two major parties in the United States, but even within both parties, there's profound disagreements over precisely these issues, which further, I think, undermines our collective strength and ability to focus and prioritize resources against the variety of threats that we need to confront.
Speaking of division, I am amazed, or maybe I'm not amazed. Actually, I made a new rule in 2020 not to be amazed at anything, but sometimes I break my own rule. And so I am amazed that when we have the largest death of U.S. troops abroad in a number of years, it can't be one single moment of national unification. It's hard to imagine national unification if a 9/11 happened now. It's hard to think how people jump to saying Biden must resign when this happens. Doesn't that strike you as alarming? It strikes me as pathetic and alarming.
Historically, unfortunately, the terrorism issue has always been or always become politicized. Now, there was, I think, a shining moment in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, and I remember this very distinctly, of members of both the Republican and Democratic Party, congressmen and senators, on that same evening, standing together on the steps of the U.S. Capitol and in unison singing God Bless America. I mean, that seems like such a relic of the past, exactly as you described, Daniel. It's almost unimaginable that the United States could come together again. And yet we see the politicization of some of the most important national security issues of our time. I mean, not just in terms of international terrorism, but the entire fallout about an independent commission appointed by Congress to investigate the January 6th insurrection. That was yet another demonstration of the profound fault lines that exist today. And this is something, without any doubt, our enemies, whether they're established nation states and great power rivals, or indeed terrorist groups, are watching very closely and believe that the fabric of trust that has kept the United States together for many years is being torn and rent to a greater extent than ever. And in the disputatious condition the U.S. is now, they see opportunity to undermine us further. And that's why I think that it's kind of a back-to-the-future scenario, is that as dangerous as the 1990s were, when we also lulled ourselves into believing all sorts of wishful thinking that the Taliban could maintain security in Afghanistan, that they would keep al-Qaeda in check, that al-Qaeda in a landlocked country like Afghanistan really didn't pose a threat anywhere else. You know, just the same way that we believed that the threat was far more diminished then, we're unfortunately, I think, embracing many of those same flawed assumptions at a time when our attention is just so fractionated and our resources after 20 years of fighting this war on terrorism. I mean, our treasury perhaps isn't depleted, but it's you know, this has been a multi-trillion dollar effort that has left the United States economically weakened, divided politically, and indeed, you know, with greater challenges in what to focus on really next. And now with this terrible pandemic really once again asserting itself at a time when we thought we had turned a corner just a couple of months ago in our struggle against it, in our profound desire to return to some sense of post-pandemic normality.
The two of you wrote an article on August 19th, which seems like a million years ago, but it was really just about a week ago or so, and you called it the Afghanistan withdrawal and Taliban takeover mean the terror threat is back, in smaller print, given how wrong the Biden administration's assumptions about Afghanistan have been, it's difficult to buy its assurances that Al-Qaeda can't strike the U.S. Okay, so you weren't exactly thrilled with what we were doing before this horrific attack. Why not?
Well, I mean, again, it was this wishful thinking, and it was this idea that somehow, without having intelligence assets on the ground, without having the benefit of a military presence, that we would still be as effective at countering Afghanistan's resurgence as a terrorist haven as we've been in recent years. I mean, the ISIS-K attack to me really underscores the perils of those kinds of assumptions. I mean, think about it. For the past, you know, 5 or 6 years since ISIS was able to establish an outpost in Afghanistan, ISIS-K has had to contend with attacks from the United States and from the former Afghan government, from the Taliban and Al-Qaeda as well. So it's faced attacks from four different quarters. It diminished and degraded the ability of ISIS-K, but certainly not to any huge extent, because we saw the tragic events at the Kabul airport. The problem going forward now is that the United States is going to lack those intelligence resources. Just today, on Friday, the president's spokesperson, Jen Psaki, said that the president is standing by his word that not only all U.S. military forces will be evacuated from Afghanistan by August 31st, but all diplomatic personnel as well. So we wouldn't have an embassy there. We wouldn't have intelligence assets. We wouldn't have a close ally, as we once had in the Afghan government, to rely upon. We're going to be dependent on our former enemies, on the Taliban, to provide us with intelligence to hunt down ISIS-K and to fulfill the president's pledge of making sure those persons are no longer on the face of the earth. Now, on the one hand, there is something of a marriage of convenience there, because the Taliban has the human intelligence potentially and the sources to provide to the United States to track down ISIS-K, but it doesn't have any kind of air power. It doesn't have the sophisticated intelligence sensors and technologies that the United States can bring to bear. But it still leaves me very uneasy that the United States is going to be dependent on other terrorists to hunt down yet a third terrorist party. In this sort of confused state of affairs, given that the success in eliminating ISIS-K in recent years was, you know, certainly didn't bear fruit, you know, it's very hard to be optimistic about the future.
But didn't we have to, but before I go to Jacob Weir, didn't we have to leave at some point? I mean, or are you saying that that decision was wrong-headed too? I mean, it's been 20 years. There's a lot of hellish places in the world, and isn't it a fact that Afghanistan has been one, and they're probably going to continue to be one for as long as I'm alive? And at a certain point, I mean, without sounding too melodramatic, to throw up one's hands and say that that's it, man, we're done.
It's tempting, and certainly President Biden has made that argument. Obviously, our prior policies or approach to counterterrorism of invading and occupying countries was unsustainable and also wrong. I don't think, though, that the complete opposite end of the spectrum of having zero forces deployed anywhere is the right strategy either. Because just as Jacob was describing earlier, I mean, we have been, despite many other failures in the war on terrorism, there is one absolute paramount success, just as Jacob described, and that's that we have kept the United States safe from another catastrophic terrorist attack. Indeed, there was the very tragic, successful attack in Pensacola, Florida, a couple of Decembers ago, but that still is not on the level of 9/11. So it's always perplexed me, why are we dismantling a system that has kept us safe? Why can a superpower not afford to have a few thousand troops deployed overseas, perhaps indefinitely? We've had 28,000 troops deployed for the past 71 years in Korea, for example. Afghanistan is not Korea, but Korea in the 1950s was also a very dangerous place. It suffered through several military dictatorships as well. It was not the economic powerhouse it was today. So I don't understand why that very small number of troops was too much. Secondly, I still believe we owe the Afghan people something. We declared Operation Enduring Freedom to liberate them from the yoke of a theologically dictated totalitarianism. And now we've turned our backs on those same people. We've adopted all sorts of, and I'm quoting former Prime Minister Tony Blair here, imbecilic nostrums and phrases like ending forever wars and, bringing our troops home. We're consigning these people, I think, to who have trusted us. And in many cases, the Afghans fought as well as they could. How could they have fought any better when we deprived them completely, not only of air cover, as we did in recent months, but we withdrew 18,000 contractors that were absolutely essential to keeping the Afghan air forces and helicopter fleets flying? How could we expect anything else? But yet we're blaming the victim. But I still believe that we have an obligation to the Afghan women, to the Afghan civil libertarians, to people who deeply believed in democracy and were working to correct what, of course, was a very flawed and corrupt democracy, but it still was infinitely preferable to rule under the yoke of the Taliban, who have shown their true colors in the past few days. I mean, whipping women and children, they're very effective at maintaining order in crowds of innocent civilians. They're far less effective, obviously, in preventing terrorist attacks, as we saw, unfortunately, in that tragic ISIS attack.
But is it preferable? Did the Afghani people want it so much? As many reports were saying that deals over the past years are made between local fiefdom warlord leaders and the Taliban. I mean, they swept through as easily as knocking a dish off the table. Where was the fight?
Well, you're absolutely right to cite these backroom deals that were made so that people could survive. But we already sold them down the river. We sold them down the river when we excluded the Afghan government from the Doha talks with the Taliban. When we went to the Taliban and commenced those talks and told them, we're leaving no matter what. Well, we basically sold them the farm, and then what minimal conditions were imposed on the Taliban when they serially violated them, we did nothing. So how could we have expected the Afghan military and security forces and the Afghan people to have done anything differently? They were on the throes of being overtaken and conquered by the Taliban, so they cut whatever deals they could to survive. And now we're even turning our back on people that are left there. And, let me bring this down to I always hate doing this because I'm an academician. One shouldn't bring in personal, issues here. But, myself and a colleague at Georgetown were almost in tears this morning, and perhaps my colleague was in tears, because we're getting emails from people in Afghanistan that are trapped there that genuinely fear for their lives, that the Taliban is actually systematically attempting to hunt them down, has been going door to door to their relatives' houses looking for them. These are former government officials. These are human rights activists. These are former soldiers, and they can't get out. And, this is the desperate situation that we've left an ally in. I mean, this is a moral abasement of the United States that I don't think we'll recover from years. In the same way that 5 decades later, we still lament the hurry, but nothing like the shambolic way we've left Afghanistan in the past few weeks, but the hurried departure from South Vietnam in 1975. We'll be talking about this for decades to come as well.
Jacob, where are you, on the same page as Bruce Hoffman?
I think so. I'll go back with I think the question a couple of questions ago where you said, why were we so critical of the decision? I'll just point out, it seems that so many of the decisions we've seen taken have been driven by a desired political end rather than security or intelligence assessments. And we're seeing a bit of an ugly kind of infight between politicians and the intelligence community right now over whether this was an intelligence failure or not. But, I think about the attack that happened yesterday, and I remember it all kind of like a movie, because I remember the 2 days before we were hearing warnings that they had a very specific terrorist threat. And then we hear stories about other countries urging their citizens to leave the area. And then there's a bombing. I mean, there are decisions being taken here that are not being driven by the intelligence and the security assessments that we have from our agencies or the military, but are driven by a desire to be able to make a political point, and that's a shame.
But wasn't the attack that just happened proof in a way that Americans should get the hell out of there and it's a lost cause? I mean, wasn't this in a way putting a sort of nail on the head of this whole thing? I mean, this attack was exactly the proof for a lot of people that we shouldn't be there.
I think that depends on how you define our reasons for being there. If you're saying that our reasons for being in Afghanistan are nation building or creating a sustainable democracy, then I totally agree with you. That's not our job, and it's not possible because we've been trying to do it for 20 years and it hasn't worked. But I think if you define our mission there as it should have been in the first place, and as I think it was, you know, when we first went there as a purely counterterrorism mission, protecting the homeland and protecting our security interests in the country, then this is just proof that it was too soon to leave, that the country didn't have the means to protect themselves from extremists, and that therefore America is once again, and Americans are once again at threat, in danger of terrorism from Afghanistan. This incident just shows that we haven't completed the mission. And maybe that meant that we needed to redefine the mission and make it even narrower than it was, even more of a counterterrorism mission. But certainly it just goes to show that the mission wasn't completed. Just to go back to your question from 2 hours ago, I think, on whether we can stay there, I'll just say 2 points. Bruce already brought this up briefly, but we do still have troops in Germany, in South Korea, in Japan. I understand the conditions there are different, but we stayed in Germany, for example, because it suited our security interests during the Cold War. And we were perfectly happy to keep soldiers there, and we still do. And I agree with Bruce. I'm not sure why this case is just different.
What does Afghanistan have anything to do with the Western world? Japan, Korea, Germany all sort of had aspirations of something better, something more advantageous for their people. I mean, it seems a little odd to say, well, Germany.
Well, I think to Bruce's point just now, I think, you know, evidently there are enormous numbers of people in Afghanistan who do believe in that vision. I totally agree. It's not, you know, it's not necessarily our job. You know, I'm not sure I would align with Bruce on saying that we owe it to them. But I do believe that the mission there was not complete in terms of what we were there to do. And that has made it premature. But I also want to say one other thing. And you know, there's this great debate in Washington right now about, as I already said, about how much do we value counterterrorism on the ladder of priorities. And the consensus, you know, is definitely pointing towards counterterrorism. It's not a priority anymore, as opposed to, for example, great power competition and this kind of quote unquote renewed Cold War. And there's been this assumption that leaving Afghanistan is good for that, you know, end, for refocusing on China, for example. And I think that's also a bit of a lazy assumption to make. I don't think counterterrorism and great power competition are zero sum. I don't think they ever have been. If we're going to refocus on China now and have that be our national security priority for the next 20 years, then why not stay in Afghanistan, a country that has borders with China and Iran and former Soviet republics, and we have a major air base there? Why not stay there when our elite troops can train with their NATO allies in that country? And then, of course, you've got the optics of walking away and turning your back on the human rights and democracy aspects. Part of the reason why we came out victorious after the Cold War is because we engaged in the world, we built strong alliances, we created a vision for ourselves and the world that was better than the alternative. And it's fine to no longer be the protector of human rights and democracy around the world, but there are consequences to that. And the consequences are that we open a vacuum that somebody else can fill. And I think there's some people who want to have it both ways. They both want to continue to be a superpower and, you know, dominate the world. But they also want to, you know, bring the troops home and turn inward and focus on America first. And I'm not sure those two are necessarily going to be possible together. It's not my place to say that we should be continuing to protect human rights or democracy, but some of these assessments that we're making, I think they're short-sighted and they're not really thinking through the implications of some of these decisions that we're taking.
Yeah, if I could build off on some of Jacob's points and answer your very profound question, Daniel, like what are our interests in a place like Afghanistan as opposed to Japan or Korea or Germany? I think, firstly, there's a self-evident, selfish interest of the United States, and that's to prevent Afghanistan from becoming a center of instability for the South Asian region, both in terms of becoming a terrorist base or a haven for terrorists. And we already know from the United Nations that in recent months, somewhere between 8,000 and 10,000 foreign fighters have already been gravitating to Afghanistan, much as a larger number had gravitated to Syria and Iraq just a few years ago, to ISIS. Secondly, I think we have a profound strategic interest in preserving the peace and stability of South Asia. We have very short memories when it comes to terrorism. Twice in the early 2000s, in 2001 after the attack on the Indian Parliament, and in 2008 after the Mumbai attacks, a terrorist incident launched by allies of al-Qaeda, operating completely separately from al-Qaeda, but ideologically and operationally at least in sync or members of the al-Qaeda universe, carried out these two highly consequential terrorist attacks in India that nearly drove a nuclear-armed India and Pakistan to the brink of a confrontation that could have been just disastrous for international peace and international stability. And that's where I think the real threat of al-Qaeda in Afghanistan comes from. Even in my sort of pessimism, I don't think that Afghanistan is going to become a launchpad for another catastrophic 9/11 type attack against the United States, at least not in the near future or the foreseeable future. I think it will become a base for destabilizing South Asia. And that's completely clear because one of the most recently newly created al-Qaeda franchises is al-Qaeda in the Indian subcontinent that has its eyes set, let us say, on one of the most populous democracy in the world, India, which also has the second largest Muslim population in the world. So any destabilization there, I think, is enormously consequential. And then thirdly, it's just as Jacob described. One way or the other, Afghanistan has always been a crossroads of civilizations, whether it's Eurasia, Central Asia, and South Asia. And certainly three of our foremost peer competitors, China, Russia, and Iran, also have very strong interests in Afghanistan. What we've seen in recent years repeatedly is that the United States becomes tired, it's enervated, it becomes politically and popularly unpopular to remain in various places, whether it's Syria, Libya, now Afghanistan. Who fills that vacuum that the U.S. creates? It's invariably our enemies, whether it's Russia, China, other countries, Iran in particular. And who derives strength from their inability to insert themselves into these conflicts and further marginalize and diminish American power. And this is just something that can't be good for the world, especially when we're talking about a very modest presence of troops. We're not talking about the 28,000 troops that are still in South Korea. We're talking about, well, 2,500, as President Biden says, was too low of a number. But of course, that number only dropped in the past year. It was closer to 10,000. It was around 8,000, and then it was around 4,500 in recent months. I can't believe that small, modest investment and the insurance that bought was something that a superpower like the United States could no longer afford. And if that is the case, then the United States is really likely to continue to decline as a superpower. Not because of staying in Afghanistan, but precisely, I think, because we departed, and in fact, the manner in which we did depart.
Let me ask a question here. And of course, you don't want to get in the mind of terrorists, or maybe you do, but when you look at the timing of this attack, you look at ISIS-K, K referring to Khorasan, region, offshoot of ISIS that we all have grown familiar with over the past few years. You look at the timing, you look at what it did, where it was. Is it now right as we're about to leave because they want to say get the hell out? Was it done as an incredible message to destabilize the Taliban's self-declared ability to, quote, control the situation? Seems to me aimed, even though many Afghani civilians killed and 13 U.S. military killed, isn't it more of a message to the Taliban, to the world, that they can't control this. Sure, great that some Americans were killed, but is that the overarching message?
Yes, I think it's all of the above. It's everything that you described. And I think, again, we have to bear in mind that terrorists are the consummate opportunists. They seek opportunities to elbow their way into the limelight and to steal some of the thunder for themselves. And that's what ISIS-K was doing. Now, look, we're talking about an absolutely heinous group that in the past has attacked hospitals, girls' schools, restaurants, hotels. So why would they be restrained in any sense when they smelt the opportunity to take advantage of the chaos and upheaval to both give the Taliban a black eye, which was certainly one of their desires, to underscore that for all the Taliban's aggressiveness, it can't control and maintain security in Afghanistan, but also to inflict pain and suffering on the United States and on the Afghan people. I mean, this is the stock and trade of terrorists throughout history, the infliction of pain and suffering. And therefore, that enables the terrorists to accrue attention to themselves and their cause. And at least amongst the more violent and extremist sectors, to hopefully win new sources of recruits and support. Of course, this was exactly the strategy that the parent ISIS embraced in Syria and Iraq, with their beheadings, with their setting Jordanian fighter pilots on fire, with drowning people in cages, with pushing homosexuals off of the tops of buildings. I mean, they found that this embrace of ultraviolence succeeded in attracting precisely the demographic they sought, which was young, you know, sort of testosterone-filled males, very, you know, very attracted and enamored of the opportunity to have sex slaves, to engage in this kind of wanton violence. So that also, I think, factors into the mindset of ISIS-K.
Jacob Weir, give us a little primer. Talk about the swirling around that's going to happen now in Afghanistan and in the region with ISIS-K, Al-Qaeda, and the Taliban. Put your hands, both of them, if you would, on the crystal ball that you have in front of you. What's going to happen?
Well, I mean, it could be pure carnage. Certainly, this incident occurring, I think, should not necessarily be surprising because, well, Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State have been feuding for a long time along exactly this question of strategy. Al-Qaeda kind of excommunicated the Islamic State because they didn't abide by the longer-term strategic vision of, thoughtful jihad that Osama bin Laden and his successor al-Zawahiri were trying to implement. ISIS has always been about pure bloodshed, whether there's strategy to it or not. So I think, you know, the worst case scenario from the realistic two worst case scenario from a jihadist standpoint is that we see, you know, the Taliban govern for sure in Afghanistan, allow safe haven for Al-Qaeda and have ISIS, Khorasan and other groups like it, even offshoot groups from that, constantly trying to undermine any kind of long-term strategic planning. And certainly, you know, I think if we see any more violence in the coming days and coming weeks and months along this level, it would be a group like the Islamic State affiliate trying to just undermine any semblance of order that there is, just for the love of the carnage, really.
What would Osama bin Laden say about ISIS?
I think he'd be happy that the Salafi jihadi ideology that he embraced and was indeed one of the foremost exponents for has found resonance in other groups, but he would bristle at the fact that this group is firstly refuses to submit to the authority of Al-Qaeda Central, which bin Laden would of course, you know, see as the foundation, indeed, as the word Al-Qaeda means, of this whole struggle. And also bin Laden would be appalled, I think, by some of the excesses of ISIS, because we know that bin Laden was far more savvier in terms of public relations and appealing to a constituency and therefore keeping Al-Qaeda's violence within the bounds of what he thought was tolerable or acceptable of that constituency. And he'd be very upset at the promiscuity of ISIS's violence and targeting.
You know, one thing that hasn't been in the news as much in the sort of big banner headlines, if you go on the website of the Council on Foreign Relations. You can read about it. You can read about it at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. But the general American isn't going to those websites to get the news, although maybe they should. But is the role of Pakistan in all of this? Obviously, it's a we could spend hours just on that topic alone, but I haven't heard the word Pakistan or seen the word Pakistan in big banner headlines in a lot of articles in the mainstream media recently, and I think I should be. Why is that? Why should I be?
Well, I think you're absolutely right to be focused and concerned about Pakistan. Firstly, Pakistan sees this as a tremendous victory because the Taliban was one of its foremost clients. But I'm sure Pakistan is also concerned about these developments too, in the sense that it's not only Al-Qaeda that has sworn the bayat, the oath of allegiance or fealty to the Taliban and to whoever leads the Taliban. It's also the Tehrik-i Taliban in Pakistan, the TTP, which is the counterpart that is just a Pakistani-only group to the Afghan Taliban. And of course, they're intent on overthrowing the Pakistani government and has carried out terrorist attacks against the Pakistani government. So, you know, we've been remiss by not focusing on Pakistan, because Pakistan certainly bears some responsibility for precisely the mess and precisely the failure of the United States in Afghanistan. History has repeatedly shown that when terrorists and insurgents have access to cross-border sanctuary and safe haven, it's nearly impossible to defeat them. This is something that the famed counterinsurgency expert, a Frenchman named David Galula, wrote about in the context of Algiers in the late 1950s. And it was, in fact, the ability of the National Liberation Front in Algeria to successfully counter France and gain Algeria's independence because it was able to use cross-border bases in Morocco and Tunisia. So this problem has existed forever. It was precisely why the United States campaign in Vietnam was undermined, because of the cross-border sanctuaries in North Vietnam and in Cambodia and in Laos. So Pakistan has played a huge part in facilitating the resilience and now the triumph of the Taliban. But at the same time, as I said, I think the Pakistani authorities must be very concerned that this Frankenstein monster potentially that they've unleashed could set in motion a chain of events that could perhaps threaten the Taliban, Pakistan through the Pakistani Taliban.
Jacob Ware, what's a short-term and a long-term scenario you see happening now with Pakistan, with the U.S. leaving, as Bruce Hoffman just said, that sort of the discomfort must be increasing? It seems they've had it pretty easy over the past 20 years, no?
Yeah, this is probably more a question for Bruce, but I certainly think states like Pakistan are now going to have to deal with the repercussions of what they've sown in Afghanistan. I mean, the Taliban is certainly aligned, supportive of the Taliban, and they will have an ally in governance. But I would certainly expect the United States to apply more pressure on the government there, given that our counterterrorism mission, as I said earlier, is not complete. We simply cannot afford to have international terrorist organizations finding safe haven in Afghanistan, finding safe haven under the Taliban. And that is now going to be something that the Pakistani government is going to have to deal with, and going to have to accept, that they have to challenge, or they're going to face escalating U.S. pressure and escalating pressure from states in Europe, as well as possibly Russia as well.
Bruce Hoffman, would ever you see a situation in which Pakistan gets so concerned about the rise of ISIS, the rise of terroristic cells in Afghanistan, they go in physically to support the Taliban in their quest for rule?
Well, it's certainly entirely possible. You know, I mean, the Taliban is of tremendous importance to Pakistan, because Pakistan has always cultivated what it terms strategic depth. In essence, by strengthening non-state actors is a way to balance out the immense population, financial, demographic, and indeed military advantages that its larger neighbor India has. So yes, it's entirely conceivable. And that's a great question, Daniel, because I mean, think about how much just a few weeks ago seemed inconceivable to us and now is very much of a reality. So I think that's a very important issue. I mean, that's certainly entirely possible.
As you both know, now we're going to take a little detour, but there's something very important culturally that I want to bring up, because as you know, it's Talking Beats, and Beats refers to music as well as sort of news beats. While everybody's personal music taste is important here, I want to make sure that everybody who hears this goes online, including the two of you, if you haven't, and sees clips of the Afghan Women's Orchestra. You can see them. They did a world tour a few years ago. They play Beethoven online. They played Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. And I think it's important now to remember that that when people say, and I hope I don't sound like I'm contradicting myself from before when I was all gung-ho about picking up and leaving, but but when people say there are going to be cultural repercussions and cultural endings given the U.S. leaving, this is sort of something that is very tangible proof. And when you watch the Afghan Women's Orchestra play Beethoven, you might get a feel for the doom that will beset these people.
It's unimaginable to think of a society without music.
It absolutely is. The thought that here you have these poor, uneducated women in Afghanistan who learned how to play instruments, learned how to play Beethoven, who was the creator of maybe the greatest piece of music of all time, Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, that's revered everywhere from Chicago to Shanghai and Afghanistan and everywhere in between, and that music resonated in a way that these people could learn how to play it and bring themselves together around the music, around the universality and the incredible humanity of Beethoven's message, I think is something that certainly you're not going to read a news article about it, but it's important for us all to remember that music was something that they didn't always have and they're probably not going to have again. The founder of the Afghanistan National Institute of Music had studied in Russia. He was a wonderful musician, and then he went back to Afghanistan after the defeat of the Taliban and founded this great music school where he taught women how to play Beethoven.
Well, I don't think you're contradicting yourself, Daniel. I think you're underscoring the complexity of the issues involved in Afghanistan. And, you know, your earlier point, I mean, the United States can't be, you know, the policeman of the world. But at the same time, my argument was that the modest investment of military forces that we had in recent years was, I think, a small price to pay for the freedom of the Afghan people as they continued to try to build and reform this imperfect democracy that indeed was corrupt. But we have to remember that 66,000 Afghan forces gave their lives as part of this struggle. They did fight. And if they didn't fight in recent weeks or months, it was because we let them down.
Let me ask a question about personnel. Not that it matters particularly, but it's a little interesting to me. The people who form ISIS-K, are they all Afghani? Are they people who came from other countries, other parts of the world? Are they imported? Or is this, how is the communication among ISIS-K working? When did this group form and who are they?
Well, I think just as we live in a globalized world, terrorist groups have become enormously global as well. I mean, we think of the ISIS parent that had 40,000 foreign fighters from somewhere between 120 to 140 countries throughout the world. And given that there's, you know, roughly 190 countries in the United Nations, that means that ISIS the ISIS Central in its previous manifestation had almost as many countries as the United Nations, which is really a terrifying thought. And of course, ISIS-K isn't quite as demographically heterogeneous as that, but there's certainly Afghans, and for many years, ISIS-K hoped to recruit disaffected Taliban who opposed, let's say, the Doha talks, who criticized the Taliban for hanging out in luxurious air-conditioned hotels while they were fighting in isolated mountainsides or rubble-strewn valleys, that thought that the Taliban had had become impure by negotiating with the West, by entering into agreements with the infidel United States. So there are certainly some Afghans. There are certainly Pakistanis who have been recruited to ISIS-K. There are Central Asians beyond any doubt, probably foreign fighters from the region as well. But I mean, this is the modern face of terrorism, is that it's a grab bag of different nationalities, which is what gives it, you know, part of the international threat. Because of course, if you have people from your own country going off and joining terrorist groups, the profound fear is that once the war is over, or once they're either victorious or more hopefully that they're defeated, they'll return to their home countries and not lay down their arms, but carry on these struggles locally, which of course is something that we've seen since the 1990s. This was precisely the fear of Al-Qaeda. It was the Arab fighters who had fought with the Mujahideen, with the Afghan forces that defeated the Red Army and prompted its withdrawal in 1989. Many of them returned to their home countries and continued to engage in violent insurrection.
Jacob Ware, anything to add to that?
I'll just say, I think this is one of the kind of the flip side of what Bruce said, is this is one of the advantages of the newer franchise model of terrorist group, where rather than have kind of a centralized body like Al-Qaeda central in Afghanistan and Pakistan, for example, or the Taliban or ISIS in Iraq and Syria, you've got localized branches that can obviously not just attract locals, but speak to local grievances as well. So you still have travelers, foreign fighters in these different groups, but you also have locals. And that's one of the things that I think makes groups like, for example, Al-Qaeda in the Indian subcontinent, which we haven't spoken about, or ISIS Khorasan, or any other group, Al-Shabaab, for example, in Somalia. That's what makes them so dangerous, is the fact that you're dealing with locals who are invested in local grievances, who know the territory, and who are in it for the long haul and aren't just there for adventure. So it's kind of a dual threat there that we face, depending on whichever group it is and whatever the individual makeup of those groups are.
Bruce Hoffman, as we said, things change by the minute, and you have your finger on the pulse as much as you possibly can. As you look to the next few days, weeks, and months, what are going to be some of the signs that you look for that things may be going really wrong? I mean, let's just assume that the U.S. does leave on August 31st. Okay, they're gone. There are no Americans there. There's no embassy there. Intelligence is shut down practically, as you said, or we'd have to rely on the Taliban and build new channels through them. But what are some of the telltale signs you're going to look for? Would it be rumblings in Pakistan? Would it be more terroristic attacks from ISIS-K, or a stronger reorganization of Al-Qaeda as they pressurize the Taliban to give them haven, to welcome them into the government?
My own focus, surprisingly, maybe a little bit less on Afghanistan and just on terrorist groups that may not necessarily be expecting attacks from, who have been perhaps a bit quiescent in recent years, but somehow may feel emboldened by these events, or may wish to, as I've described earlier, steal some of the thunder for themselves. The Al-Qaeda franchises or ISIS franchises elsewhere than South Asia. I think that there's an immense threat of them attempting to capitalize on our preoccupation or distraction with events in Afghanistan and South Asia to perhaps sneak under the radar and carry out a highly consequential, or at least attempt to carry out a highly consequential terrorist attack. Not a 9/11 type of catastrophic attack, but something like 2004 bombing of commuter trains in Madrid, the 7705 bombings of London Transport. I mean, something like that. The attack on an Ariana Grande concert in Manchester only a few years ago. I mean, those would be sufficiently unsettling, and terrorists themselves elsewhere, not in South Asia, but in different parts of the world, may now feel a sense of confidence or empowerment to at least attempt to take advantage of our focus on events in Afghanistan to try to get away with the terrorist attack. That's what will concern and worry me in the coming weeks. And then I have to say, too, closer to home, we shouldn't forget that just a mere week ago, we had a terrible incident on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. Fortunately, it was resolved. There was no bomb in the truck that this individual was driving. But the threat of another Oklahoma City attack, now unfolding as it potentially could have just last week at the corner of the Library of Congress and the Cannon House office building, is sufficiently alarming, too, that we've got to pay attention to the threat of domestic terrorism, too, just as we discussed before the 2020 election. I'm a bit unsettled by the fact that in mid-September there's going to be a rally for justice for the January 6th wrongly imprisoned individuals. I mean, we're facing, I think, a multiplicity of threats that Jacob described at the beginning of the interview, both, unfortunately, domestic and international. And all we have to do is think back 20 years to 9/11, where we were sufficiently unsettled by a threat from one terrorist group in one place. We have multiple terrorist groups in multiple places, including in our own country now.
Just two quick follow-up points on that. I think, even if everything looks like it's going okay in the short term, thinking a bit more long-term, I think there are two messaging repercussions that I'm really concerned about. The first, Bruce already kind of touched on, the message that's been sent to terrorist organizations, guerrilla organizations around the world, that if you stay in the game, if you think long-term, you can defeat superpowers. It's the same message that Osama bin Laden took away after they defeated the Soviets in Afghanistan. You can outlast superpowers. Guerrilla warfare, attrition strategies, they can work. You just have to be patient, stay with it, because eventually the group that you're fighting, the nation you're fighting, will get bored and they will leave. The other message I'm much more concerned about, actually, and that is this is not the last time we're going to see a civil war or a intrastate conflict that has U.S. national security implications. I'm deeply concerned now that we're going to lose would-be partners based on what we've done, first of all, to the Kurds in Syria, who fought and died for Americans fighting the Islamic State in Syria. And then we walked away and allowed them to be butchered in some cases by a Turkish invasion. And now we're doing the same thing to our Afghan partners. So next time there's a conflict somewhere where we're concerned about U.S. national security concerns or, issues that might arise, and we're looking for a partner on the ground to fight for us or ally with us, I think it's going to be much more difficult to convince that group, that non-state actor, that government, that we're worth allying with, because we've now walked away twice and just let the people on the ground who fought for us deal with the repercussions. And I think that's a terrible message, both for counterterrorism purposes, also for the great power competition.
Well, on that note of deep optimism, I think I'd like to wrap it up, although we could certainly go on for hours. I hope there's going to be a next time. You two make a terrific pair. And indeed, thank you so much, Bruce Hoffman. It's great to talk to you again. And Jacob, we're so glad to have you, and come on back.
I will. Thank you, Daniel.
You've been listening to Talking Beats with Daniel Elchuk. The original theme music is by Ronald Barkham. The content coordinator is Nathaniel Mosse, and Doug Christian is executive producer. We invite you to subscribe and leave a 5-star review on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere you get your podcasts. You can support us at patreon.com/talkingbeats. That's patreon.com/talkingbeats. And be sure to check us out on social media. We'll see you next time on Talking Beats with Daniel Elchuk.